Hello, I'm Andrew, and with me yesterday was Steve.
Oh my god, that was the coolest thing I've ever seen!
It certainly was. Just too insane, too brilliant, too amazing. Hello and welcome to the Cosmic Shed. Today's episode is all about space stuff, I guess. We've just watched Sight in the Shed and watched the Falcon Heavy launch a cherry red Tesla with a spaceman in it into space. And we're about to talk to Peter Beck, the CEO and CTO of Rocket Lab, who you may have heard of because he's just launched the Humanity Star, the graffiti, space graffiti into space. But first, Steve, tell us about that amazing SpaceX launch.
We have just sat in the shed through, was it a 90-minute pause from the start of the launch window?
Something like that.
And we've seen Elon Musk's SpaceX launch the Falcon Heavy, the first test launch of the Falcon Heavy. It's the biggest rocket that is now currently in use. It's not the biggest ever. That was the Saturn series, Saturn V, I think. Yep. But it's the biggest in current use. It's got the capability of going to orbit, going to the moon, getting stuff to a Mars transfer orbit. It's got, was it 9? No, 15. It's got loads of engines.
27, I think.
27, you're right. Basically, it's 3 Falcon 9s strapped together.
Right.
Which is just phenomenal to see.
That is insane, isn't it? Do you know what? I think the most insanely brilliant thing I've seen was those two rockets coming back into land exactly the same time, perfectly alongside each other.
Yep, so the two first stage boosters were recovered on two launch pads back at Cape Canaveral.
Yep.
And we've seen over the past few years some exciting hits and misses from the. I remember when they had their test rocket, the Grasshopper, where they were practicing landing rockets upright, which just looks wrong. Mm. But they fully nailed it today. And then the second stage comes back down and lands on a. Well, it's supposed to land on a drone ship in the middle of the sea. Now, we didn't see that, and one reason for that is due to the vibrations caused by the landing, cutting off the comms, but we haven't heard whether that was successful or not
yet. I'm sure by the time you're listening to this, everyone will already know if it was successful or not.
And then the money shot. It was the fairing coming away from Elon Musk's cherry red Tesla Roadster, first series, with a spaceman, what do they call him?
Starman, isn't
it? Starman, that was it. Starman, wearing one of SpaceX's proposed, like, new space suits that look very sexy.
Don't they?
Sitting in the Roadster with Don't Panic written on the dashboard. allegedly, the hi-fi playing on loop, David Bowie's Space Oddity. That's certainly what Elon Musk tweeted a few months back when everyone thought he was taking the mick about doing this.
Seems to be life on Mars to me, doesn't it?
That's what they had in the background, wasn't it? Yeah. I wonder if they couldn't get the rights to Space Oddity. Yeah. But the whole story behind that is test rockets generally launch with a test payload, which is quite often a block of concrete or steel, and couldn't be more boring. And someone tweeted a few months back at Musk, what's the test payload going to be? And he replied, my cherry red Tesla Roadster playing David Bowie's Space Oddity on loop. And I was like, oh yeah, that's really funny. Very funny, Elon. And then they put it on the rocket. And then I think yesterday they announced they'd had approval to launch it, which seems a bit kind of close to the bone to me. It's not going to orbit Mars because that would eventually end up with it landing, crash landing on Mars, and that would be really bad because I imagine it's quite hard to sterilise a second-hand Tesla Roadster, and that would cause all of our extraterrestrial research to be for naught.
Okay, so what's a transfer orbit?
it's an orbit that you can get from the Earth to Mars in. So if you chuck something just hard enough in just the right direction, it'll go out to the same orbital distance from the Sun that Mars is at, and then come back, and it'll just keep doing that around the Sun.
Okay, so I just feel like before we watched that, right, before that just happened, and I can't quite believe that just happened, but it did just happen. I was thinking, okay, I was believing the PR that was being put out by SpaceX and Elon Musk, and I was thinking, it's a test flight, and if they manage to launch it and it doesn't blow up on launch, then that's a success. But I have to say, having watched that, I feel like it's opened a new era of spaceflight.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree. There's so many things that have to go just right to make something like that happen. Even in the initial launch, you got 27 rocket engines, massive, massive rocket engines. You've got all of the different separations of the stages, the ignitions of the next stage. It's just the amount of engineering that goes into that astounds me.
Yeah, it's phenomenal, isn't it?
It's a real feat of human effort, inspiration and ingenuity.
It totally is. Well done, SpaceX. Well done, everybody.
If you haven't seen it, watch it. It's literally a 10-minute video from launch to recovery of the boosters and everything. Yeah. And it's just phenomenal.
Totally amazing. We'll obviously post a link to it on the Cosmic Shed website. I doubt any of you listening haven't already seen it. But we need to go and talk to Peter Beck of Rocket Lab. And so I don't know how I feel about it right now.
So I'm not entirely sure about the controversy. He's putting something into orbit that's going to stay there. Well, he has put something into orbit that's going to stay there for 9 months. You're going to be able to see it glinting in the sky. Now, I can't imagine that something the size of what he's launched is going to be as bright as the sun or even the moon in the night sky. So I want to ask him what the reality of the situation is.
Let's talk to him. How are you?
Oh, very well, thanks. Did you watch the SpaceX Heavy launch?
Did we watch it? Did you?
Yeah, no, it was good. Yeah, that was great.
Yeah, it's insane, right?
Yeah. No, it was an awesome job.
Have they said what happened to the drone ship landing yet?
I haven't heard, but I know they use the same kind of uplinks as we do, and you get a bit of vibe on those antennas, and you know, your pointing accuracy has to be pretty good, so we'll see.
Yeah. Did you reckon he was going to... Well, he, I say he. There's a lot of people involved. Did you reckon it was going to happen?
I mean, the Falcon 9's, you know, proved pretty reliable, so, you know, I thought they had a good chance of pulling that off.
Yeah.
But still incredible. Yeah. You know, congratulations to them.
Yeah, amazing, isn't it? So what have you done?
The Humanity Star was a project that that I wanted to do for many, many years. In fact, you know, a fair chunk of my life. And, you know, it all kind of stems back to a couple of things. If you ask, you know, the general population where they live, they can tell you what city they live. They can tell you what, you know, block they live in and what country they live in. Hopefully they can tell you what planet they live on. But you go much past that, and the vast majority of people can't tell you or name the planets in our solar system. And you know, for me, it was always you know, looking up into space was always something that as a lot of space people do, just, you know, something that was a part of your life. But the whole point of Humanity Star was really to get people outside and get people looking up and realizing that they are on this little giant, you know, this little rock in a giant universe, and hopefully get people thinking, you know, a little bit more broadly and widely, and thinking bigger about the world they live in. Because, you know, the reality is, you know, as a species, we're facing some pretty decent challenges. You know, one country is not going to solve climate change. We're going to have to come together as a species to deal with that issue. And you know, there's a number of things. And if we take it to the extreme, you know, 6 billion years left to run on the sun, at some point, this is not going to be the place that we're going to be. So really the whole point was to start the conversation, get people outside, the people outside who wouldn't normally go outside, and get them to look for the humanity star, and hopefully in looking for the humanity star, look past that and into the universe and start asking the big questions. So that was really the whole point of it. You know, not we knew that it was going to miss the mark for some people, and obviously people who, you know, look at the night sky all the time, you know, they get it. But the kind of people I'm trying to get out are the people that don't do that and who don't get it and don't understand that, you know, we are just this tiny little civilization on this rock in the universe.
I think getting anything into space is amazing. My day job is at the University of Bristol in our aerospace engineering department. So can you just tell us a bit more about the background, about Rocket Lab, about Electron, and what you did to get Humanity Star into orbit?
Rocket Lab is one of those 10-year overnight successes, you know, where, you know, started the company 10 years ago, and really it was all about access to space. And the Electron project's 4 years old, and, you know, I started the Electron project. It was very obvious that the small satellite market was going to, you know, continue to grow exponentially. And really the key to access to space was frequency. So when we first started designing the vehicle, you know, basically I wrote two things down on a piece of paper. It must be affordable and must be launched at least once a week. And those were the two things that really, you know, those are the only requirements of the whole program. So everything that you see that we've done, you know, draw lines right back to that. So all the technology, the composite tanks and electric turbo pumps and 3D printing, all of that drives back to those two requirements. And, you know, the launch site, the reason, you know, there's a launch site in New Zealand and not in America is we just couldn't achieve the launch frequency out of America. There's just too much stuff going on. So what we really needed was, you know, a small island nation in the middle of nowhere and, you know, happened to find one of those. So, you know, that's the only reason that, you know, the launch site is there. People think that, you know, Pete's a Kiwi, so that's why he's doing it in New Zealand. It's just not true at all. It's I needed launch frequency. And, you know, where we're at the moment is we have a launch site. It's the only private orbital launch site in the world, and we're licensed to launch every 72 hours for the next 30 years.
Is that what you're doing?
That's the goal, is to try and get that frequency up there.
Wow. So what are you going to be launching?
The satellite industry is going through some pretty amazing changes. So if you look at the numbers, so the big geosynchronous birds, the numbers that have been built and launched are pretty much static in numbers. They're not really increasing. In fact, some of them are declining. But if you look at the small satellite industry, you know, the growth in that is absolutely exponential. And when you're trying to put a constellation of 20 or 10 or even more satellites in orbit, you know, it really doesn't make a whole lot of sense to just spew them all out in one clump because you need to spread them around your orbital plane. So, you know, a small launch vehicle that can you know, responsively and frequently launch small satellites into orbit is the way to build this new, you know, space infrastructure.
A bit about your Electron rocket. Is this your first
Yep.
major rocket? Have you had a build up to this? Have you scaled it up, or did you go for the main event straight away?
Well, I mean, back in 2009, we launched the Tier 1 series, which was a small sounding rocket, and we were the first private company in the Southern Hemisphere to reach space. But there's not a lot of heritage. Well, in fact, there's no heritage, componentry, or anything between those, other than the fact that it was an all carbon composite vehicle, and we used, you know, some pretty innovative avionics and all those kinds of things. But it really, I guess, it's the ethos that has flowed, you know, flown through to the Electron program more than anything.
You said it's an all carbon construction.
Yep.
Is that unusual for current rocket technology?
Yeah, I believe we were the first all carbon composite vehicle to ever go to orbit. You know, usually carbon composites are used for parts of the launch vehicle. You know, we start off with, you know, a raw carbon tube, and that forms all the tankage and structure of the vehicle. So, you know, the vehicle is carbon from nose cone to, you know, to tail. Once again, you know, we didn't do that because we just love the black stuff. We did that because it was the only way that that we could achieve the performance and the flight rate, the build rate. You know, we start off with one raw tube and just bond in bulkheads, and you know, in the space of a week, have a whole tank. Whether you know, you think about the way you do it traditionally is you start off with aluminium, and then you know, it's like building an airplane. You form stringers, and then you rivet all the aluminium together, and friction stir weld it, and paint it, and stress relieve it, and on it goes. Whereas, you know, we can produce a whole tank in a very simple process. Significant weight savings, but also significant manufacturing savings. Mm. You know, it's just so simple and quick to build a super high performance tank. And, you know, and it wasn't without its trials. You know, we had to develop you know, a whole lot of technology to handle the liquid oxygen, the cryogenic temperatures, the liquid oxygen, all the differential thermal expansions, and you know, it was quite a big research program to actually, you know, develop an all carbon composite tank. Mm-hmm.
And is it a single use rocket?
At the moment, yep, single use. For a small launch vehicle, it's very difficult to get the economies to be able to reuse. So, you know, you trade so much of your payload to be able to reuse. And, you know, when you've got, you know, tens of millions of dollars tied up in your booster, it's really worth that payload, you know, trade to get it back. But when you can build the boosters so unaffordably, then it, you know, the economics become much more challenging.
If I don't think it's visible from the UK at the moment, right, humanity style. Mm. But if I was to look up and see it, what would I see?
So it's deliberately placed in an orbit such that you really need to be looking down on the horizon at dawn and dusk. So you know, it's not this giant shiny thing brighter than the moon, you know, piercing above your head. You need to really hunt out for it, and that was kind of the point. Is we wanted people to go and look for it, so they, you know, in looking for it, they actually get to see the universe that's around it. So if you want to see the Humanity Star, then you know, if you go to the website, it'll tell you where it will be from your area. And we're still refining the algorithm, so that'll continue to improve accuracy. But where you're going to see it is at dawn and dusk down on the horizon, and you'll see it a couple of flashes.
Okay.
And that will distinguish itself from a normal star.
Okay. So it'd be like an iridium flare type flash? Is that what I should be looking for?
Yeah, pretty much. So it'll be, you know, very short. The iridium flares actually last a bit longer. It's a short little flash.
Okay, cool. And have you had any? I know I'm picking up from what you're saying that you've had a bit of backlash from some people. But have you had people saying that it is making them look up and it's a great thing? And...
Oh yeah. Oh, I mean, we've had so much, and you know, for equally the kind of people that you know, that's missed the mark on, there's an equal number, if not more, who has had a profound effect, you know, it's we get just hundreds of emails a day of people who are excited about it and who have experienced it, and you know, it's certainly certainly having a huge effect. And, you know, when I think about, you know, what got me into space, it was when I was about 4 years old, my father took me outside and showed me a satellite. And that was just a mind-blowing experience. What's this thing in the sky? And then, you know, I remember asking all the questions, you know, well, what are these other stars? And is there anybody looking back at me? Or, you know, it was kind of a, you know, hang on a minute moment. It's just great to see those moments occurring for a whole lot of other people around the planet.
Yeah, no, totally. And it's I'm going to put some questions to you. But people have said to me, who are from the astronomy community, right? So, you know, Don't blame me, right? But one of the questions people are asking is, they're quite sensible questions, really. But did you speak to anybody about it before?
I mean, you have to go through a whole licensing process, both in the US and New Zealand. So it had to be bought off by both the New Zealand government and a whole lot of licensing processes. And we're very careful to make sure that we put it into an orbit, a very short lifetime orbit. It put it in a place where it wasn't going to be, cause great issues to anybody. But, to put it into context, that the whole reason was to get people discussing and talking about the bigger issues for humanity. And, although, like I say, it's missed the mark, some people, they still are talking. It's mission success. And if the conversation is, we really don't like the Humanity Star and, it's supposed to help us think about, humans as a species. Well, the fact that has even come up in the conversation is a definition of success.
Yeah. Is there any risk of what's it called? Is it Kessler effect?
Kessler syndrome.
Kessler syndrome. Is there any risk of that with this?
You have to explain me the Kessler syndrome.
Well, I believe where one thing in orbit collides. Have you ever seen gravity, right? One thing in orbit.
Oh, right. No. Okay. No. I mean, so we had the option of putting up a mass simulator that did absolutely nothing. And that's typically what you do on a first launch vehicle. Or the option of doing something that will have an effect to a large portion of the population and something that the whole planet can share in. So, in that respect, we use the payload wisely. But we can't just put it any old where, it was very, very carefully placed all through the right regulations to ensure that it wouldn't cause any of those kinds of effects. And it's a very short term life, it's only up there for 9 months. We put it into context with SpaceX's launch on a 1 billion-year lifetime. It's a very short, glinting moment in Earth's history, mm-hmm. And like I say, if we change just a few people's perspective, they may be the few people that are the world leaders in the future that have a big effect.
So, Humanity Star is your cherry red Tesla Roadster, just a little bit more visible to people on the ground.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't necessarily say that it's my. It's kind of my roadster. It's meant to be something for everybody to share and not and I hope it has a little bit more meaning for everybody. There's something a little bit deeper behind it than that.
How do you put something in an orbit so it's only visible in dusk and dawn? How do you do that?
Yeah, so that's to do with the inclination. So, we put it into an 83-degree inclination in an elliptical orbit. Just the way – there's got to be a lot of things that need to line up for it to be visible. So, firstly, it has to be nighttime. Secondly, the sun has to be at exactly the right portion of the sky to reflect off the panels. And then, obviously, thirdly, you've got to be standing on the ground as the ball is rotating to be able to reflect it to your point on the planet. So, if you stand outside for the next 9 months in the one place, you'll have about half a dozen opportunities to actually see it. So, it's not a giant persistent thing in the sky. It's something that you really have to search out for. And that was exactly the point, is to get people looking for it and actually going outside and, the definition of success is them just going outside and looking up. Whether they see it or not is largely irrelevant. But at least they've gone outside and they may have had a conversation about this little rock they're floating on.
Yeah, and you don't think, because some people have said that it's going to interfere with sort of astronomical observations and stuff. Do you have anything to say on that?
Well, I mean, that's why we put it in the orbit that it is. It's, like I say, there's very little astronomical work done at dawn and dusk on the horizon. The day has begun. So, or the day is ending. So, you know, there's a tremendous amount of light there already. Yeah. So we really don't see it should affect astronomical observations at all.
Okay. Have you seen it?
I haven't personally seen it. It's coming over me in Auckland in a couple of days' time, so I will be looking out for it. But some of our team certainly have seen it.
Cool.
Just on the controversy aspect, it sounds to me like things have been blown slightly out of proportion, particularly given the detail that you give us. I think one of the reports was a little bit clearer than others and said they were worried about multiple tens of satellites being launched in quick succession, hundreds or thousands sort of blotting out the sky. But we're already in a situation where we've got a lot of things in space, right?
Exactly.
If we wanted to send something into space with you, how do we do that?
Well, I mean, I guess the first thing is you'd contact us, and then we would look at your payload and make sure it's something that we want to fly and something that that is going to survive a flight.
Okay.
Then you have to go through the various licensing organisations. So, you know, if it had communications on it, you need FCC licences. It have any optics on board, you need NOAA licences. You'd need wherever you are or building the satellite, you'd need that country's approval and licence and government's licence.
Yeah.
You'd need the US government's approval and licence. And then finally, because it's launching out of New Zealand, you'd need a New Zealand approval and licence.
So I'm guessing a garden shed would be out of the picture, but what sort of payloads are you looking for?
Yeah, so we have a wide range of customers, ranging from early stage startups looking to put satellites in orbit for entirely new ideas, through to very sophisticated scientific payloads from NASA. So we have quite the spectrum of customers.
So NASA is a customer of yours?
Oh yes, yeah, they're on flight 4.
What are they sending up?
They've got a suite of 12 payloads and various spacecraft. There's some really, really awesome stuff on there, some really, really neat science.
How cool is that?
That's pretty cool.
How did you end up launching stuff into space? Well, tell me a bit about you.
Yeah, like I say, it came from that very moment. I think I must have been about 4 or younger when my father took me out and pointed up to a satellite and said, "Oh, this is cool, isn't it?" And for me, that was kind of the moment where it was just like, "Well, hang on, this is a little bit too much to comprehend." And that was where the fascination started for me. And I was not so much now, but an avid astronomer myself. So captivated by space. But I am from a family of engineers, and for me it was I love doing things that are really hard. What was harder than this? So I started building rockets when I was at school, and built rocket bikes and rocket packs and all kinds of things. And I reached a point where in my career I'd been corresponding with a whole lot of folks in the US, and I went over to the US on a bit of a rocket pilgrimage. This was when how old was I been there 24 or something like that. No, it was later than that. But anyway, I went over to the US on a rocket pilgrimage and visited all of the, NASA and Aerojet Rocketdyne, all those companies. And really, there was two things that I took out of that. Is one, firstly, it wasn't how I thought it was. I thought that, small launch would be very obvious and everybody would be gung-ho for that. We sort of learned that it was a little bit more, and this is pre-SpaceX days, it was much more conservative than I realized. The other thing I realized is that what I was doing back in my workshop wasn't a million miles away from what a lot of other companies were doing in their laboratories. We had the same combustion and stability issues and using the same kind of instrumentation. So it's kind of a moment where it seemed the right time to just step out and try and form Rocket Lab. So on the plane trip back, I doodled the logo, landed, quit my day job, and then started Rocket Lab.
Amazing. Is your favourite film October Sky?
Oh, it's a good film. Yep. No, it's a good film.
Or Contact.
I don't think I've got a favourite film, to be honest.
Okay. Well, you're a science fiction fan, though, right? Surely.
Not really, no. I can't read fiction, no.
Really?
No. Fiction for me just seems like a wasted energy. Unless I'm learning something, it just seems like a waste of time.
Okay.
So, no, I'll sit down with George E. Sutton's Rock Propulsion Elements before I'll sit down with a fiction book any day.
Okay.
That was a classic.
Yeah. Peter, just launch some stuff into space and then read Asimov. That's what I'm going to say. Find some time for it. It's worth it.
All right, will do.
or The Martian.
Or The Martian, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I saw the Martian movie, so that was
fun. Yeah, you enjoy that?
Yeah, it's good.
Cool. I've got one last question. Steve might have more. I've got one last question. How does it feel then? Is Humanity Star the first thing you launched into space?
Well, technically, we'd deployed one of our customers' payloads first. So we had deployed a Planet Labs Dove satellite first, and then about half a second later, deployed Humanity Star. So if you want to be technical about it, then it was the second thing.
I'm fine with that. Tell me how it felt.
Well, I mean, that was a great flight. So Test Flight 1, bit of back history. Test Flight 1, we were so close to getting to orbit. It was a third-party ground system software error that caused that flight to be terminated. So we would have got there on Flight 1 most likely. So we had good confidence on Flight 2. But nevertheless, to get to orbit in two flights is pretty decent for a new company. But getting to orbit was truly fantastic. It's just incredible for the whole team to have achieved that. And it's not like we went to orbit by using a whole lot of other people's stuff. We went to orbit with totally new technologies and totally new materials in a totally different kind of way. We had these flights highly instrumented. And, we learned a lot from Flight 1 and it gave us the confidence to hit to full production. So, the next flight is a full commercial flight and we've got another six lining up in the factory. So for us now, it's just all about starting to eat away at our backlog of customers.
Cool. When is the next flight?
So the next one will roll down to the pad later this month and then... We're doing some mods down at the pad to enable a higher launch frequency. So although the vehicle will be down at the pad this month, it's probably late March, early April, we'll get the next one away. But the following flight will be right on the heels. It'll be just a number of weeks after that.
A bit more about Electron. What's different about Electron compared to other rockets that are in use at the moment?
So there's lots of high level and low level stuff. We start at the high level is firstly, the rocket was designed for manufacture from day one. So typically, you'll design a rocket for performance, then you'll work out how to make it. Every single designer, every single piece of avionics, everybody had to justify, to me and the other engineers, was that the most cost effective and most mass producible way of designing that thing. And we ended up doing a whole lot of things on the vehicle that you normally wouldn't do because it needs performance. Like we have one cryogenic valve, and that one cryogenic valve, we use two of them on stage one and one of them on stage two. And we also use it as our vent valve. So we have a fill valve and a vent valve, which are identical valves, and they're the same throughout the whole launch vehicle. And normally you wouldn't do that because a stage one valve needs to be much bigger, so you'd optimize a valve for stage one, then you'd optimize a valve for stage two. But we kind of make those trades, all the way through the launch vehicle. And then, when you start to dig deeper, you look at the Rutherford engine. The whole reason for inventing that new electric turbopump cycle was to decouple a really complicated thermodynamic problem. If you take a rocket engine and you say, what are the bits that cost the money? What are the bits that are technology risks? And it's always the turbopumps. So to remove the turbopump from the equation was really, really important. But of course, it created a whole lot of other interesting challenges. You know, we carry a, we use up a megawatt worth of batteries in 160 seconds. So they're not your average double A's. They're a pretty special battery to be able to draw that amount of energy.
Okay, super. So there's a lot of, I guess, economies of scale if you're making three valves the same compared to one, and then some other innovation. But your primary driver here is cost. Then you're getting launch cost down.
Primary driver is actually frequency.
Okay.
Frequency. I mean, cost is important, but customers come to us first because we can give them some certainty around their launch schedule. Mm. Because they're trying to create a business, they're trying to get their satellites in orbit as fast as they can in the right places to generate revenue. That's the end of the, you know, it's the bottom line. Mm. So, you know, the way that they're operating at the moment is they get to go on a rideshare mission, and they get kind of some time they get on orbit to somewhere rather than, you know, where and when they need to go. So frequency and reliability schedule is number one, and then obviously cost is a close second.
Moving away from the vehicles to your launch site. So your launch site's quite unique. Are there other launch sites in the Southern Hemisphere?
Not sure there's any operational ones.
You're certainly the first private one. Sorry.
We're the only one private one in the world, but yeah, I'm not so sure that there are. Actually, okay. That's not something I've looked at.
And you're geared up for polar orbit launches, yeah?
Well, that's the beauty of that launch site, and one of the reasons why we selected it is we have the largest amount of launch azimuth than any other launch site in the entire world. So we can shoot sun synchronous right up to 39 degrees out of the one site. There's just nothing out in the ocean. So, you know, if you're in America, you want to shoot sun synchronous, you're out of Vandenberg, you want to go to the space station, you're out of KSC. You know, we can go to the space station or sun synchronous out of that one site.
Just explain what a sun synchronous orbit looks like.
So for us, it's shooting south at about a couple of degrees off 90. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as the name implies, you know, it's an orbit that maximizes the duration of the spacecraft and the sun, so it synchronizes with the sun. Particularly useful for Earth observation.
Mm-hmm. Can we come and work for you, please?
Absolutely. That's one of our biggest challenges is we're scaling at a rate that's pretty high at the moment. So at any one time, you know, we have about five new starters a week in New Zealand and a few in our US factory, about three new in our US factory. So,
okay.
You know, we're hiring and scaling flat out right now.
Okay. Take him on.
I sat the two space systems courses at the University of Bristol 15 years ago. And the scale and the conversation that we're having, the intentions that you've got about the frequency of launches are just crazy compared to how we were back then. We've got a ton of students on those courses now, so I'll be sharing this podcast with them. I share an office with Dr. Lucy Bertud, who is our sort of primary space scientist, space engineer at the university, and we've just launched our fledgling CubeSat lab, so I'll get them in touch with you, shall I?
Excellent. I mean, that's the wonderful thing is CubeSats have just enabled so much to occur in the space industry, and you know, students can build their own satellite. I mean, how cool is that? And you know, the biggest thing to be done in space is yet to be thought of. You know, space has been such a closed domain that, you know, unless you want to get there, you've got to write a check for millions of dollars. Now that's all changed, and you know, the ability to experiment and innovate is now there. So you know, we think of space as a great platform for, you know, satellite television and communications and a bit of GPS. But look, I'm, you know, super excited about the next generation and the ideas and concepts that they're developing to use space to better everybody on this planet. It's just phenomenal.
I feel like you're doing it for the right reasons. Okay, I feel like it's the thing is called Humanity Star. That's not the whole thing of the company, but that's called Humanity Star. The reasons for that, I'm behind them all. What if somebody wants you to launch into space something that is counter to how you want the future of the world to be. Maybe it's a military thing. Maybe it's something else. I don't know what else it could be, but something else. And there's a lot of money in it for you. What do you do? What do you do?
Well, I mean, look, I'm the CEO. I don't have all control over everything. But the mission of the company is very clear in what we're trying to achieve here. And if it's something that is very contentious and not really following the mission, I really don't see how that would that would fly very well. Even if I wanted to do it, or I got comfortable with it, or other people wanted to do it for other reasons, it's still got to go through a tremendous amount of checks and balances. So the New Zealand government, for example, has a very very strict foreign policy on such things, and I could never launch a weapon to space. I would just step out before that would happen. So that's
awesome.
That's my view on it.
Lovely. Thank you so much. Are you good?
I'm good for now.
Cool. Peter, thank you so much for talking to us. And
my pleasure.
Yeah, we're going to keep. How do we follow you on Twitter? How does everyone listening follow you on Twitter and keep up with what you're doing?
Well, I mean, you can go to our website, of course, and then we have the Rocket Lab Facebook site, and also, as you mentioned, the Rocket Lab Twitter site, and we post pretty regularly any updates, but keep a lookout for the next launch. And we'll be streaming that live again, so I hope everybody can enjoy it.
Cool.
I am really, really looking forward to seeing where Rocket Lab regular launches, small payloads go. It's such an exciting time for space. So thank you so much for answering my many questions.
Oh, look, my pleasure.
Awesome. Thanks so much.
Thanks very much,
see
you. Guys.
Have a good one. Cheers. Launch your car into space one day, I guess that's what you do, isn't it?
Just a little dinky one.
I've got a camper van, right? My camper van is we've made a theatre show in my camper van called the Apollo 11 camper van. We reimagined the Apollo 11 command module journey that Michael Collins had in a camper van. It's about to fail its MOT. If it fails its MOT, will you launch it into space?
No, I'm sorry.
Yeah, it was worth a go, wasn't it?
Yeah.
All right. Cheers, Peter. See you. Bye.
Thanks very much.
Bye.
Cheers.
Lovely man needs to watch more sci-fi.
Does need to watch more
because
sci-fi.
There's so much in sci-fi that I think we're aspiring to, and it brings more people into space science, space engineering, just aspirational. Stretch goals.
Yeah, I think it chimes with his worldview. But he did say he liked October Sky and The Martian. He's doing all right. I'm sure there are still some people listening who've got question marks about it. I hope Peter did answer some of those things. He certainly spoke to the criticisms that I'd heard and answered them pretty well. I think it's the way that I think about it is I think about it the other way round. And if I had the opportunity to launch something into space, I'd launch it into space.
Yeah, I think the risk is it becomes too commonplace and everyone and their dog and McDonald's is launching promo crap into orbit and we get full-blown Kessler syndrome and everything starts falling out the sky on us. But I think we're a little way away from that at the moment.
Yeah.
What do you think? I could talk about space all day, so let's do that. Please tweet us
at the Cosmic Shed,
and let's have a chat.
Totally, speak to us. I'm just too excited. I enjoyed tonight a huge amount watching stuff being launched into space, and then talking to a man who launches stuff into space.
Very cool. When's Elon Musk coming on the Cosmic Shed?
I don't know, Elon. If you're listening, we'll have you. Peter probably knows him. We'll get in touch. And thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.
Bye.
The Cosmic Shed.
Science fact.
Science fiction.
And everything in between.